All right, well, how would you answer the first question on the quiz? B as in boy, okay. And how about number two? C is the correct answer. What's the matter with the question? That's probably a lot, but go ahead. Well, it's not just getting it. But if there's a problem, tell me. I can always rewrite it and make it worse. Pass those over, please. Yeah. Okay. There was a question that was raised last week that I meant to tell the whole class the answer of and forgot. So we're going to try for this morning instead. Some people noticed on the front of the handout it talked about the fact that there were other books that were available, at least on the syllabus rather. It talked about the A to Z Drug Facts by Facts and Comparisons. It's a little paperback. It's about yay thick by yay by yay. If you want to have it as something extra, you're certainly welcome to. It gives a little synopsis of the information on most of the drugs. The PDR, you're not going to carry that around. It's too big, too heavy. If you want it, it's something else you can get. But the final question had to do with, well, what's available for a PDA and what's the easiest thing to put on a PDA? There's a program that's called Hippocrates. It begins with an E. You can download a free version for drugs only, but then there's a complete version that they try to sell to practitioners that basically has in it all kinds of stuff. Has in it diagnostic criteria, values for labs and things like that, has in it, I think, a huge dictionary, as well as the database for all the drugs. And so you can go back and forth between different sections of it. I'll bring mine in and show it to you sometime. But if you're into that kind of thing and you want to get into the technology, the PDA and Hippocrates is really a nice thing to have. And like I said, the Hippocrates DX, I think, is still free on a download. And it's updated periodically. So Joe Gibson gave me a new computer, and I still can't hot sync to my PDA. So sabotaged by Joe, as you may well know. But anyway, yes, sir. BRS is, I think, probably the better one. First Aid for the Boards is good. The High Yield series is, you have to have a good knowledge base before you use it. So if you hammer the course all year and all you want to do is quick reading, you know, on a Friday morning, then it's good, but it doesn't have much detail in it. So I don't know. Whatever's best for you, I guess. All right, we're going to pick up where we left off. We were talking about different kinds of interactions. There's something else that affects how drugs act in the body. And it has to do with an area of the science, and it's called pharmacogenetics. So it's basically looking at gene-related changes and how that might apply to pharmacology. The biggest example that we talk about a lot has to do with patients who are known as slow acetylators. So there is a change in the acetyltransferase gene so that you end up with an enzyme that doesn't work at the same rate as does the parent enzyme. And so people that take drugs that have to be acetylated to reduce their activity have drugs with longer half-lives. One of the biggest examples that it's usually talked about is isoniazid. Which is an anti-tuberculin type drug. So pharmacogenetics, the genetic differences will affect that patient in the same way all the way through. So if you've got a lot of different drugs that have acetyltransferases being important, then this could be an example. We also have compounds we'll talk about in autonomics, succinylcholine, is a skeletal muscle relaxant. It is hydrolyzed by acetylcholinesterase that's in blood, also an acetylcholinesterase that's in red blood cells. And there are patients that have a deficiency of this enzyme. And that could be a pharmacogenetic variation. So understanding genetic differences is important. Excuse me. And the response is unique for an individual. If you know that they have this particular gene difference, and consequently the enzyme difference, then you expect that person to respond to certain kinds of drugs in a similar way, and that will be true. But they'll be different from the normal population. So pharmacogenetics, genetic variation can be important in the metabolism of certain drugs. Okay, as we go on and think about other things that might influence the responsiveness of drugs, we can talk about environmental factors. What environmental factors do you think might be important? Stress, okay. Now, how's stress going to impact things? Okay, metabolic rate could be higher. It's one issue. What's something else? Most people take meds orally. What does stress tend to do to the GI system? So it can have an impact on tone and motility. Anytime you speed it up or slow it down, you're going to affect the absorption rate of drugs. What about other things, environmental toxicants. There are a lot of inducers that are found in, say, diesel exhaust, automobile exhaust, that turn on enzymes to metabolize drugs. So a person from the dirty city is going to have a different, potentially a different way of dealing with drugs than a person from the clean farm. But is the farm so clean? What's the farmer doing? Constantly putting down pesticides. So now you've got a different exposure scenario. So there are a lot of things in the environment that can impact how drugs and chemicals work in individual patients. Gender differences are also important. There are known gender differences in the expression of the cytochrome P450 family of enzymes. And that's probably the biggest gender difference that's important. There are others. But differential expression of cytochrome P450s is the biggest. What about disease? Disease has a number of impacts. If we think about liver disease, you can affect all of metabolism. If the drug undergoes biliary excretion, you can affect removal of the drug from the system and dumping it into the bile. So you can affect things that way. I'll get back to you, Sean, in just a minute. You can affect binding proteins. After all, the liver makes most of the globulins and albumin, things of that nature. So if drug binding is important and the liver is not producing normal levels of albumin, then that can have an impact on plasma protein binding. And while we're talking about hepatic synthesis of things, we could think of synthesis of blood clotting factors also. So patients that have liver disease may have compromised blood clotting systems. It might not be noticeable until you throw a drug on board, and then you get an exaggerated response from the drug. And that's because there's less of the protein available. You don't normally go measure proteins, you measure bleeding times. So these are just some examples of effects through the liver. Okay, Sean, you had your hand up. It has to do with specific isozyme families. 2E1 is a little bit lower in females than it is in males. The particular cytochrome 2E1 that's alcohol dehydrogenase is different in females than it is in males. What other cytochromes? The D family is lower in males than females. 3A4, which is the most important family for drug metabolizing properties, is about the same in the two genders. So it's just a differential expression of proteins that are involved in drug metabolism. Okay, so we dealt with the liver as one site of disease. What about renal disease? You can have a decrease in glomerular filtration. That can affect lots of things. You can have an impact on tubular secretion, tubular reabsorption. You could have defects in the ability of the collecting duct to pull water out. That could have an impact then on drugs. Also in the distal convoluted tubule as well as in the collecting duct, something important happens in urine. Remember what it is? Okay, so you get your increase in osmolarity, that's one thing, but what does the distal tubule primarily do? It dumps something into the urine. So it's a site of potassium exchange, that's true, but that's not what else is exchanged? Where is the urine acidified? Isn't that the distal tubule? Okay, so acidification of the urine can be impacted if you've got renal damage. If a patient has damage to Bowman's capsule, what might get into the urinary filtrate that wouldn't ordinarily get there? Proteins. Proteins got drugs stuck on them. So you lose drugs that way. So when you think about renal disease affecting different parts of the kidney, you can have differential responses and impact then on drug response by a patient. Okay, I skipped the heart. Where's the heart important here? Circulation. So if hepatic blood flow goes down, what might you think would happen? Clearance of the drug through the hepatocyte would go down, as just a very simplistic answer. If renal perfusion drops, you have a lower chance of getting the drug into the urine. So the heart's important in terms of its ability to pump the blood around and maintain normal organ perfusion. So if you impair organ perfusion, you can have impacts on both clearance or removal, as well as impacts on biotransformation. If there's no drug there, it's not going to get changed. Another disease function that impacts things is thyroid dysfunction. How might thyroid dysfunction impact? Changes in metabolism. So you can alter biotransformational capacities in tissues. There's also another special effect that we often talk about, and that is that thyroid hormone levels impact catecholamine function. So normally you've got a certain amount of catecholamine that's circulating around. Under situations of stress, you get a lot more catecholamine dumped from the adrenal medulla. And how the body responds to that is also a function of normal thyroid balance. So if thyroid levels are too low or too high, you can get abnormal responses to these catecholamines. If thyroid levels are too high, and you've got too much circulating epinephrine, you can actually predispose a patient to cardiac arrhythmias. So anyway, thyroid dysfunction impacts catecholamine response of the body and it impacts biotransformational capacities in tissues. The last response that's listed on the system has to do with things like allergies. Individual differences in allergic reactions and sensitivities. Many patients might end up coming in and having a little bit of a rash to, say, a drug. Are they truly allergic to it? A lot of drugs in and of themselves can produce a rash, and it's not an allergic response. But many people think that the rash is the first step, you know, in an allergy. And so this is what they read on the internet. And so they come in and they tell you, I've got an allergy to this drug, I can't take it. But there are going to be people that do have allergic reactions to drugs. So when somebody says they've got a rash, you can't discount it. You're going to have to do a little investigation. So realize that the immune system and allergic responses do occur in patients. It tends to be a lower percentage of patients, but it becomes an issue. A lot of people are allergic to the penicillins. Sometimes they get cross-allergenicity with the cephalosporins. So now you got two major classes of antibiotic that you can't use in that patient. But are they truly allergic to it? Some will be, and a lot of people won't. But you still have to investigate it, because allergic responses become very serious things. So when we think about this, I've got five different things listed here: genetic variants, environmental factors, gender differences, effects of disease state, and allergy-related issues. There's one that should have been added that didn't get on the list. And what might that be? Yes, sir?
Diet.
Now, diet has an impact. That's probably an environmental issue, but that's a good one. There's something else I'm looking for. Is there a difference? Yes. Age is absolutely important. I was about to ask, is there a difference between you and grandma? And the answer is yeah. And we'll talk about those differences in the next block. Yes? Yes. What drugs might be? What properties would those drugs have? Say that again? A low volume of distribution. So they're in high concentrations in the bloodstream. What else would be important? Well, Size might be important depending on the membrane that the dialysis machine is using, but most drugs and chemicals go across the dialysis membrane pretty readily. But there is something else that's important. Drugs travel in the bloodstream by themselves, protein bound. So if they're protein bound, they won't be dialyzed. So the extent of protein binding has an impact on dialysis. So yeah, size, polar nature, charge, degree of protein binding, impact whether or not it's, and volume of distribution. Okay, what about some of these age-related differences that we can talk about? Well, first, before we get to age, let's talk about pregnancy. There are a host of drugs out there that are fetal toxic. You're never going to remember them all. We're going to talk about some, especially in when we talk about some of the drugs in hypertension. There's a class of drugs that's fetal toxic, and that'll be important for you to remember. But in terms of pharmacokinetics, what do you think changes in pregnancy? Yes. Okay, huge endocrine differences that could affect the expression of various enzymes that are involved in biotransformation in particular. So that's one issue. What's another issue? Increased volume of distribution. Blood volume changes dramatically in the woman. But then, as Kelly said, you've got the addition of now another compartment, which would be the fetal compartment. When we think of the plasma, the placenta itself, the placenta is a pretty good barrier to a lot of chemicals. But that doesn't mean that it's perfect. So lipid-soluble drugs can pass the placenta pretty easily, and they do so by just simple diffusion. So that shouldn't be very surprising. Now, if you get drugs that are a pretty good size, say greater than 1,000 Daltons, those don't move across very well unless there's an active transport system that it can piggyback on. So placental transfer becomes an issue. There's usually a doubling of plasma volume. So just to get the idea of how much the volume can increase. So pregnancy is important, and you need to think about it. Okay, what about kids? Kids have enormous differences depending on age. So even as a fetus, beginning as early as about 5 months of development, they can begin to metabolize drugs. So drugs that do cross the placenta that could be metabolized by the child into, say, a toxic intermediate become a concern. There's a whole book on drugs in pregnancy and lactation that lists all of these kind of agents. And so the good news is you don't have to remember all these details. Just go get the book. But if you go into OB, you're going to know them because those will be the ones that you're going to worry about. But little people, even as a fetus, can metabolize drugs. When, right after birth, let's talk about a newborn. Neonates tend to have a differential expression of P450s, a differential expression of glucuronosyl transferases. That shouldn't be so surprising because what other protein is different that you can think of? Hemoglobin. So it's the same sort of thing. It's just a fetal expression of certain isozymes, and then others become more normal as the child ages. Typically, by about 6 months of age, the P450s have ramped up to normal levels. There is one glucuronosyl transferase that doesn't really show up until about 6 months, but once it shows up, it's like boom at normal levels. Why that is, no clue. So when you think about drugs used in these small kids, then you got to remember that biotransformation is not up to normal yet. But typically by about 6 months to age, it is. The second thing that happens has to do with the kidney. Renal perfusion doesn't get up to normal until several months after birth. So it's functioning, it's just not functioning at what you would consider to be a normal level. The other thing that happens is when you start looking at the effects of chemicals on, say, neonates or something like that, you might think, oh, this could raise blood pressure or this could raise heart rate. I'd better see what the heart rate is. What's a normal heart rate in a six-month-old? Anybody got any idea? Real fast. So heart rates in a neonate can range from 120 to 140, 150 beats per minute. I mean, they can gallop right on along. And so it's difficult to know if a drug is increasing heart rate. What about blood pressure? Any clue? Blood pressure often starts out at kind of a rule of thumb of 80 over 60, and it increases by a point per year in terms of diastolic and by 2 points per year in systolic. That's a real loose definition, but if you were to see a chart that had blood pressures at various ages, that's kind of what you would see. So, kid comes in, they got a blood pressure of 86 over 63, and they're 3 years old, what's their blood pressure? It's normal. But if you're not thinking this is a three-year-old and blood pressure is going to be low, and you think, man, it's low, you've missed the point. So when we think about how drugs can affect blood pressure, how drugs can affect heart rates, you got to know what the starting point is. And the starting point differs with age. So let's see, GFR is down in kids to about 6 months. There's an increase in total body water as a percent of body weight. Turns out there's really less lipid storage in a newborn. So with more body water and less lipid, you change the way drugs can distribute within the body. So distribution can be a little different. So kids, up to about 6 months are really different. And then after that point, they begin to grow and mature into something that you would consider kind of the normal reference range for an adult. What about the other end of the spectrum? Let's talk about the elderly. Elderly are kind of similar to kids in the sense that things are now ramping down. Instead of starting down and going up, they're going in the opposite direction. So GFR is headed down, biotransformation's headed down. You begin to see differences in organ perfusion starting at about age 60. And that's assuming everything's okay. So changes do occur as a function of age. Lipid storage is increased in the elderly. There's decreased total body water. So drug distribution is different. One of the other things that's important to remember in the elderly, and this is probably the most important thing because you never see it in textbooks, and I'm not sure why, but if you talk to a geriatrician, they'll tell you this. Many drugs that are CNS acting produce exaggerated effects in elderly. They're more sensitive to the drugs. Whether they're more sensitive to CNS active drugs because there's a greater distribution of drugs there is not totally explainable. That's not the only thing that's going on. And one of the first things you see is just confusion. And so if if a patient comes in and they were perfectly lucid the last time you saw them and now they seem to be somewhat confused and some family member says, look, this person's gotten kind of wackola. You know, one of the first questions to ask is, okay, what drugs are they on? And do we need to begin to decrease the dose? So, decreased GFR, decreased transferases, decreased P450s can all occur in the elderly. The good news is there are dosing charts that are available for kids. And so you can get one of these dosing charts and you can look on it and you can see, well, for a six-month-old that's body weight is this, you should give this much of that particular drug. So you don't have to remember the differences. There are charts that will help you do that. Okay. What about lactation? Do drugs get into breast milk? Absolutely. What kinds of drugs do you think would be getting into breast milk? Anything that's lipid soluble. You bet. Turns out most drugs can be detected in breast milk to some extent. If you've got a patient that's on some kind of a chronic med who wants to nurse, what is one trick that you can use to help reduce the amount of drug that gets into breast milk? You can have her nurse before she takes her med. Because theoretically, she should be at the low point of the plasma concentration, and if she's at the low point of the plasma concentration, then by simple equilibrium thinking, you would have less getting into the breast milk at that point. Is it really true? Well, I'm not sure it does because everything's at steady state if you're on a chronic med. But that's the conventional wisdom. Have them dose themselves after they nurse. Anyhow. Social and community context of healthcare perspective. There's an enormous pressure by the pharmaceutical industry, and I think it's basically called CYA, to have patients on chronic meds not nurse. Is that reasonable? Is that rational? Huh? Okay, so you need to think about risk benefit. It's not reasonable. A blanket statement is not good. You should begin to have specifics. Okay, this drug might not be a good idea, but that drug might be fine. Well, I can think of a lot of reasons not to. The first one is a function of my wife's response to that question, which would be a breast pump is hell. A teething child's not much better, but a breast pump apparently is total misery. Now, that's her bias, but I can't relate to that, but... No, I didn't try it. Although I will say that I did have children who tried to latch on to me, though. And let me tell you, when they get on just a tuft of skin, I mean, you can have an appreciation for just how hard they can suck. You just wait till you get your own and you'll find out. But anyway, so this is an issue. There's no simple explanation to it, you know. Obviously, if the woman doesn't need the drug and they want to nurse, then if they can stay off the meds, then you lower the risk to the child. But if the woman is on a chronic med and they need to be on that med doesn't necessarily prevent her from nursing. So you just got to balance it. It's all risk-benefit issues. Okay, any questions on all of this then in terms of variations in drug response and drug interactions? Pretty simple and straightforward. Okay. Well, how do we get a drug to market? what all is involved? This is a gross oversimplification of the process. And it also implies that everything is very rigid. And it turns out that in terms of time, things are much more fluid. And if in doubt, it will always take much longer to get a product to the market than you anticipate, just because some governmental agency will probably get in the way. What about you're in the lab, you've got all these compounds, you've done a screen, you've got a this one has some promise. So you go in and say, okay, what can we do? Well, it's not uncommon to spend several years, once you've identified an agent that has promise, doing acute studies. So we can talk about animal testing, short-term, long-term, and what are we really looking for? The basic laws that are in place today require that a company prove two things: that the compound is efficacious and that the compound is safe. So how do they do that? Well, when they start with acute toxicity testing, one of the first things that often happens is, and this was in the news a couple of years ago, as animal rights people are still very much anti the LD50 determination. The first thing they want to do is find out what's the lethal dose. How much compound does it take to kill an animal? So you take a bunch of rats, you give them a bunch of doses, and you find out where the LD50 is. That's simple enough. With those animals, you're usually only concerned with what's the LD50. Now, once you find it, you then go back and say, okay, what all does this compound do? And so then you choose typically three doses, and you use both male and female animals, and you dose them up with those doses, and then you take blood, maybe urine, tissues, after some prescribed period of time, and look to see if there's any kind of damage. So in blood, you're looking at typical CBC, blood chemistry profiles, looking at enzymes that are released from all kinds of organs. When you take the tissues out, you're looking for both gross as well as microscopic anomalies. So all the histopath might be done. Once you get a drug that looks, oh, this is promising, this looks okay, you then might switch into something that's more long-term. Now, when you're doing a long-term study, which in rodents is typically 2 to 3 years, you're looking for something. You've got three doses, got both sexes. What you're really worrying about now is, will they produce more cancer than would be found in the control animal? So depending on which species of rat you might choose to study, some species are incredibly good at producing certain tumors. Others don't produce tumors very well. So most companies will actually choose the rat strain that will produce tumors. So you'll have tumors in your control group, but you're looking for an increase number in the experimental groups. And is there a dose dependency? In other words, if tumors show up higher in the high dose but not in the lower dose, does that mean that we can go forward and study this amount of drug? Besides doing whole animal type studies, there's a whole battery of tests that can be done. There are probably 15 different mutagenicity assays that are routinely performed by companies to try to understand whether or not the chemical is mutagenic. Does it produce a change in the DNA? There are also studies that are done to determine if it affects reproduction. So reproductive studies can be done in a couple of ways. One, you can end up treating the male. Typically, because the process of spermatogenesis is so long, you typically would dose a male rat for 2 months. You would then mate them with a normal female that hasn't been exposed to the drug. and see if they are able to produce pups. If so, how many? Do any of those pups have, you know, is there a higher number of deaths than normal? Are any of those pups showing anomalies? So lots of different questions there. With the female, they tend to dose for 14 days before they're mated with a normal male. And you tend to look for the same kinds of things. With reproductive tests, you can go multiple generations. So you can take a male and female offspring from dosed animals and mate them. So they tend to go out two generations. So there's just a whole host of information that's gathered in these animals and in vitro. And as you can see, with a chronic toxicity, chronic teratogenicity, carcinogenicity study, you're going to go out 2 years, 2.5 years just with the animal treatment. And now you got to start analyzing the data, looking at the tissues, trying to understand what you have. So it's a tremendous amount of investment. So people often ask, why are new drugs so doggone expensive? Because the profit off of those drugs is trying to pay for the development of the next new drug. And the development of the next new drug is going to be more expensive than the previous drug. Now, do they need as much profit as they get? We won't go down that road. So anyway, at one point, this isn't on the list here, but you can have what's called an investigational new drug application. So back at this point, you've kind of got something that looks promising. You file an IND with the FDA. You're saying, hey, we got something interesting here. We want to test it. We want to go forward with it. Then you begin your studies and you get a new drug application submission. Before you can get to the NDA, you have to begin to do clinical studies. And the clinical studies are set up as, some people say four phases, some people say three phases. But three phases are required for the FDA. In phase one, you're dealing with normal volunteers. You might have special populations, you might not. You could deal with, say, if a specific disease, you're wondering, does it affect, say, diabetic patients better than normal patients? You can look at hepatic renal impairment type patients. But basically, these are individuals that are willing to just try the drug. What are you really looking for? Major therapeutic benefit? No, not at this point. What's the drug doing? The bigger questions. What are its pharmacokinetics? So you're trying to get biological effects, trying to discern, is it metabolized, and if so, how? You know how it was done in the rat, because that's what you studied before. Maybe you also use dogs in the study. Typically, it's done in two species. But now you got to find out what it is in humans. So this starts the whole process off, phase one. Let's get a group of people in. Let's give them a drug. Let's see what happens to them. With phase two, now you've got the big push. You know you've got something that's promising. You're willing to invest a lot more money in it because this is going to open up to a larger number of patients. You're looking again for efficacy. Remember, to have it approved, you got to prove efficacy. You're trying to narrow down the dose range that you want to use for that efficacy. And you're always looking for changes in kinetics and things like that because it's easily measured. But eventually, you get into a phase three trial. Phase three really expands things. So if you want to think about it in terms of numbers, phase one might involve 20 people. Phase two might involve 100 to say 300, 400, 500. Phase three is getting up into the 5,000s. So a much larger number of patients. And these phase three trials typically are done in multiple places in order to get that many patients. So you got all this data. And so the NDA goes in, the new drug application goes in. You know, you could have a book like this or bigger. that has all the information in there for the FDA to approve or to read through, to analyze. The FDA process is long-winded. Average, as you can see, is 2.6 years to get the drug from the NDA went to the FDA, and the FDA came back to the company and said, okay. So it's a long process. But here's where most of you guys are going to be really important, and that's this so-called phase four, post-marketing surveillance. What happens here? Obviously, the patient base is expanding as more and more patients are given the drug. Here's where you begin to pick up the rare effects, the weird effects. And who sees most of this? The average clinician. How does the FDA or the company find out about these weird effects? They ask you to help them. And so when you've got patients that are given drug therapy and they have an adverse reaction, they ask you to fill out certain paperwork and return it. Is that a pain in the rear? Yes. Is it extra work on you? Yes. Do you get paid for it? No. So, will you do this? Yes. It would be nice if you would. A lot of people don't bother. That's a great question. This is the time when they are done. A lot of it may be found out up here, but you can't use it off-label until the FDA gives the company approval to mass market it. Once it's out in the marketplace, you can do anything you want to with the drug. There is, but it varies. It depends on the agent. It depends what the issue is that you're asking for the variance.
What happens to this process when it's sped up from drugs like HIV?
This process pretty much stays the same because it just takes time to do those kinds of studies. This is the process that's supposed to shrink. Get it out of the FDA faster. The goal is 3 months. So you're knocking over 2 years off the process. And that's significant. But you still got to have all the data. Without that, it's hard to make a rational decision. But post-marketing surveillance is important. And from all of our perspectives as consumers, it would be really nice that if something weird is seen, that that is transmitted to the company so that if it's seen again, And again, even if it is 1 in 10,000 patients, it might be serious enough to yank the drug off the market. So that information comes from you, the practitioner. And it's voluntary. But please, do it.
When it comes to off-brand or
off-label use, if they change how they make the drug, there are limitations and exclusions. So if you change some things, then you don't even have to tell the FDA. If you change other things, then you have to go back and ask for approval again. So depending on what you're changing may not matter. The second issue is, let's say you want to market that for now a new label. You have to go back to the FDA for approval. How much data is required? Only the data that shows that it's efficacious for that particular use. Theoretically, you see, you've already established safety. So now if you want to change it, instead of saying this is an antihypertensive drug, I want to use it for as an antiarrhythmic. First of all, you can write it for that without having approval. But let's say the company wants the approval. Then all they have to go back in and show is it's efficacious as an antiarrhythmic. And it does not require all of this. In fact, that data may already be available from the original trial. It's just that they looked at the information. You know, this is a funny thing. It's not always necessary to, since you can use it off-label, it's not necessary for the company to necessarily have approval to market it that way. So, you know, does the company need to go through the expense of getting it approved for that particular use? So sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Yes, sir. Say that again. Well, they pay for it all the time because they don't know what the use is. Okay, so if you prescribe something for me and I show up at the pharmacy and I hand the pharmacy the ticket, I mean, you know, the insurance company is not going to know why you use that drug. That's HIPAA. The insurance companies stick their nose into a lot of things. Any other questions? Let's take a break, if not. But those are oncology. I mean, you're already dealing with a sick patient at that point, you know, and you're dealing with a disease process that will probably take their lives, and there's a limitation to what you can accomplish. What about all the other things that are out there that could benefit a little person, but we can't give them because they haven't been approved for 12 and under yet?
Yeah, no, I mean, it was exciting for oncology just because,
yeah.
You know, I mean, for pediatric oncology, just